House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, February 11th, 2009. We're going to go out of order just briefly. The first bill we'll hear, and it's a public hearing only, on House Bill 2278. They're getting together. There's going to be some amendments. And Rennell, if you want to just come up and give us a brief rundown on that, and then we'll...
Good afternoon, for the record, Ron Alshenko with the Attorney General's Office. You do have House Bill 2278 in front of you, and you have written testimony from several folks that were planning to come to the table today. However, as Chair Barker indicated, we have requested and he has agreed that the Department of Justice will go away and have a little mini ad hoc work group to work on some amendments. We knew we needed to do some amendments. In a nutshell, what we will be bringing back to you is this policy choice. Currently, child support judgments are good for 25 years. And it's 25 years from the date of the original order when that is entered, and it runs purely and completely for that amount of time and then stops. It's not renewed. Nothing changes after that point. That isn't always working for some of the family scenarios where you have multiple children born at various intervals throughout the life of that order. So we want to talk about that and talk about what options would work best for everyone. So we will go away with your blessing and involve in our work group to date Jack Monroe with the Oregon Land Title Association, Carl Stecker and Conchetta Schlesinger with the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Sybil Head with Legal Aid Services of Oregon and the Oregon Law Center, and Matt Minahan with Dad's America and, of course, the Department of Justice.
Okay. Okay, with that, we'll just wait here later so we don't spend a lot of time today. Oh. Public hearing on House Bill 2278 is closed. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2393.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a committee, House Bill 2393 comes to you from Representative Cohen.
Oh, yeah.
It increases the fees and assessments that the sheriffs may charge when serving process and other documents.
Okay. Brian Wallace, Tammy Wood, and, well, that just that too. I'm sorry. Please identify yourself before you speak for the record, and then you can go in either order, however you'd like to do.
Okay, Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Wallace, and I'm the Chief Civil Deputy of the Marion County Sheriff's Office, located at 100 High Street Northeast in Salem. And I'm also a former president of the Sheriff's Civil Command Council, and I am here today on behalf of our civil law enforcement professionals throughout the state, Oregon Sheriffs for Action, and the Marion County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Russ Isham, to testify in support of House Bill 2393, and I thank you for this opportunity. Real quick note, there are technical amendments to House Bill 2393 which have been passed on to Legislative Council, I believe late last night. As a result of the technical amendments, the bill may not be ready for a work session today. Written testimony was just submitted to be a part of the official record, and that said, I'm going to give you a quick summary of the contents of this bill, since you have a lot of other stuff to do today, I'm sure. Section 1 to 3 of the bill increases sheriff's fees for service and execution of process. Some fees, should be noted, haven't been changed since the 1980s. Section 4 to 6 pertains to internet posting for sheriff sales. This doesn't change anything that's already contained in statute, other than a sheriff can now enter into an intergovernmental agreement to maintain a website for the purpose of giving notice of sale under a writ of execution. And Section 7 to 8 makes it more clear as to how a sheriff is to proceed. On how a sheriff is to proceed when notified of a challenge to a notice of garnishment. Currently, the statute is silent, and the proposed language that we submitted is consistent with what is contained under a writ of garnishment statutes. And finally, Section 9 to 11 ensures that a law enforcement agency that seizes a gambling device or phishing equipment will remain that agency that is responsible for the custody and storage of that equipment, which is just better for chain of custody and evidentiary purposes in a court of law. So thanks again for having us appear before you, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead, and then we'll ask.
Okay. Well, for the record, my name is Tammy Wood. I'm with the Linn County Sheriff's Office. Started off wrong there. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name's Tammy Wood, and I'm here today for the Linn County Sheriff and for the Oregon Sheriff's for Action, and I'm here on behalf of them to urge your support of House Bill 2393. I think my colleague covered most everything in the bill in regards to raising the service fees. We have not had a raise on process service fees for 6 years. And that was only a $3 fee. The last increase for the other fees was 23 years ago. In Linn County, we took in $137,000 in revenue. However, it cost our taxpayers over $500,000 above that amount that we took in to serve process. And for the most part, the people we're serving for are not our local citizens. They're bill collectors, corporations, banks, credit card companies, and those costs are recoverable in court. Other than that, I think that my colleague has pretty much covered the rest of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Wisnap.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain Wood, there's a lot here. Let me just bring some concerns, and maybe you're going to maybe be back, or we're going to talk about this. But there's a lot in this bill, or in the staff measure summary. One question is, I guess I've been told that the actual serving of the legal documents, a summons, a subpoena, a citation, is by tradition or something, and and I want to know who pays that fee. And could that document be served by a certified mail or registered mail instead of by an officer?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnat, historically, sheriffs have always served fees, and that goes, or served process, and that goes back to England. There is an appellate court decision from the 80s that state that the sheriff must accept process and serve it. He can't shirk those responsibilities. That case was a divorce case. The recession was going on, and the sheriff of, I believe it was Jackson County, refused to take in process so that he could use those resources for patrolling. He was taken to task on that. It went to the appellate court, and the appellate court said, no, Sheriff, you must take process and serve it.
Thank you, Captain Wood. That's very good information. The other concern I have is down here we're talking about who controls, you know, the gambling device and the fishing boat and the sheriff or the fishing gear and all that. Well, let me back up. I don't think, Captain, who's paying the fees? Is the court or the...
Representative Chair Barker and Representative Wisnat, in a seizure like that, this is a law enforcement seizure, so there are no...
No, excuse me, back to the... back up to...
Pays for service.
On the subpoenas and the citations.
It would be the plaintiff. The person who's bringing the action against the defendant, they pay for those costs up front, and then once they get a judgment then they are able to recoup that as part of the judgment.
Excuse me, if I may. For example, if I was going to file a small claims complaint against Representative Wiston, I would have to pay you the subpoena fee, and then you would deliver it to him. Is that right?
Yes.
And what you're saying is the fee I'm paying you does not cover the cost of you serving it.
No, it does not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair. So we're back to the fishing gear and the boats and all that. Now, the staff summary sheet, and I haven't picked it up in the bill yet, says that the law enforcement agency that collects it retains it. We've had a problem in Deschutes County with property accountability and things like that. How is it accounted for? Does the sheriff's office know if this other law enforcement agency has it, and so there's some dual checking on that property? property so it's maintained?
Chair Barker and Representative Wisnan, I can try to answer that as clear as possible. Right now, the way that the statute is constructed, for whatever reason that may be, a gambling device is considered a public nuisance, no matter where it's at in this state. And if a law enforcement agency, let's just say Salem Police, would seize that public nuisance gambling device, the way that the statute is constructed right now, they could say, Sheriff, you get to take it into your custody now. Our contention is that that just doesn't make any sense. They've got their own property room. It taints the chain of custody, and it's just better if it's kept with that law enforcement agency that does the seizure in the first place. That's all that this section of the bill is doing.
Short follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. But you said the staff summary, and I apologize, it may say different in the bill. The staff summary says the law enforcement agency. Could that be the lottery commission or?
Whatever the definition of a law enforcement agency, I'm assuming that would be state police, city police, the sheriff's office, any county or state agency.
Is that in the bill?
Mr. Taylor.
Chairman, as a committee, what we have, and it's on page 7 of the bill, 6 and 7, and basically what we have is it relates to gambling devices, which are not going to be sold after they're seized. I assume the statute says it'd be destroyed, and I assume they are. But what you have is the sheriff takes them now. So if the local police department seizes them in a gambling raid, they turn them over to the sheriff. The sheriff holds them for, I assume, until such time as they're destroyed, I assume after the legal proceedings. You have the same thing for fishing boats used in commercial fishing. All boats, fishing gear, and vehicles used in violation of commercial fishing laws or rules of State Fish and Wildlife Commission may be seized. Currently, it's held by the sheriff. Now my assumption is if we're, say, seized by the state police game, they would be the agency that would be holding the material. My assumption is that somehow there is a confiscation and possibly a forfeiture of the items, too, particularly if there's a criminal matter involved, which then puts it into the forfeiture laws, and my assumption is that they were sold, the proceeds would be distributed pursuant to that, with the agency doing the seizing probably getting some of the money back, at least for their costs.
Okay, last question.
Please. No, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, especially with experience on the committee. So, is that documented when it's confiscated and there's accountability that's, you know, because that didn't happen in Deschutes County in one occasion.
When property seized, whoever seized it is responsible for it.
Right.
And currently it appears that then if I'm making a case from Portland, I happen to be in Washington County, then I would tell the sheriff, come get it, and you store it. And he's saying, you store it. It's your case. And that shortens the chain of evidence so that I don't have to then subpoena in the officer from Washington County to come in and say, yes, I took it from him and I put it in the room and here it is back. And so I think it has to do with that. But it's so the seizing agency would be responsible for it rather than turning it over to the local sheriff.
That's all right.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yes, Representative Barker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. So I have some questions. Really, this bill does four distinct things. It's in four parts, each of which could easily be an individual bill and have different things to think through. The first one was the increase of fees, the most straightforward of them. I actually had a question, and it seems reasonable. I understand that, I mean, your costs to the extent of the fees currently do not cover the actual costs that that your offices face. Clearly, we need to change that. I just wanted to push back specifically on line 15 of page 1, which is a service fee. If there are more than two or more parties at the same address, that was you're increasing that by a full third. And I just don't know if there's really an increase in marginal cost there. And being that it's often required, for example, in an FED action, you often have to do it to the tenant and also to parties in possession. This really is, I just wanted to push back on that. And if and when it comes, I'm going to be asking about that. And Mr. Chair, if I may continue, I actually then had skipping to the second part of the bill, which is the intergovernmental agreement for the purposes of establishing a website. Now, I am assuming, when I read the statutes this morning, that ORS 18.900 at SEC, that the reason you are requesting this change is because there is not an authorized state website that has not been implemented, presumably for funding reasons. Is that correct?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
And can you explain this more to us? Because this is, I think, a substantive matter, and the statutes authorize a pretty broad exception to what has been, a traditional process of notice requirement. That literally, I think before the founding of this country, from common law on, if I'm not mistaken. And I want to make sure that we understand what's happening here and what these intergovernment agreements will happen. And I'm also concerned that this might create a patchwork of basically different notice requirements from county to county. Did that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It did. Chair Barker and Representative Barton, let me back up to page 1, line 15, for the two parties at the same address. We took into consideration, as you stated, the FED, and we felt that it wouldn't be fair for a landlord who has multiple tenants to have to pay a substantial increase. So we're asking for that nominal increase of $5. Sometimes we have to make a separate return of service for each party that we serve, depending on if we receive separate original summonses. I won't get into that, but that's why that increase is fairly small. And with regards to the legal notice part up on the website, this all started back in 2005 when the Oregon Law Commission got together. And a big concern was providing better notice to the community, because at sheriff sales it was oftentimes just the creditor or the plaintiff that would show up and bid at a sheriff sale a very, very small amount, a credit bid, if you will, and then take possession of the property, whether real or personal. This gets our intent is to try to have one agency that would be responsible, other than the state court administrator's office, to post these notice of sales, sheriff sales, and sheriff sales only, in order to get a better turnout at these public oral auctions. And that's a win-win, really, for the debtor and the creditor, because the creditor is going to get more on their judgment, their money judgment, and the debtor is going to then absolve or deduct more from their judgment. Right now, I can tell you of many cases in this state where people will show up to a sale, one or two, and they bid pennies on the dollar for a vehicle or a boat, and it just doesn't really sit right, I don't believe, with the debtor-creditor group, with the Oregon State Bar, the OLC, sheriffs, even though we're ministerial officers. We have a little bit of heartache selling stuff for $1, and it's legal. So the idea behind this is to get this website up and running, have people, sheriffs, post their stuff, and that is strictly on the instruction from the creditor. The creditor is going to tell the sheriff the best way to provide that notice, whether it be a newspaper publication or the internet or both. And so that's all that this bill is doing. Is it's already in statute, and we're just kind of taking that burden away from the state court administrator's office. And we've had talks with them, and they're all for us taking this and rolling with it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace, and I appreciate your argument. I'm referring specifically to the website now. I appreciate the argument, and it's a compelling argument. It is a good one, and the intent, I think, is persuasive, that we want to increase turnout at these auctions and create a meaningful market. And I'm sure that is your argument you just made is exactly the argument that was made in the 2005 session when this legislature adopted ORS 18.926. My concern, however, is not with your argument, but with if we're going to do this, we should do it at a statewide level. Otherwise, we're potentially creating a hodgepodge of different counties, different. It would just lead to less predictability. And I'm concerned it will make a good intent worse.
Representative Barton, just so you know, the sheriffs have discussed this statewide, and their intent is to have one central place and not have that hodgepodge, not have two sheriffs over here create a website and maybe the Oregon State Sheriff's Association over here and maybe the state surplus over here, and we're having all these different websites out there. The intent is for a couple of sheriffs to bare minimum for legal purposes come together with that agreement, establish it, and then all the sheriffs will jump on board with that. So there should not be a hodgepodge of different websites out there. That would defeat the purpose of the intent of this. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry to belabor the point, because first of all, that's a great intent, and if that is in fact what will happen, then there's no problem here. But that's not as I read this statute, and perhaps it might require some modification, etc. Also, one final point, and then we can move on, is that I realize we're not going to work this today. It might be appropriate to shift this change into a different bill alternatively, because as currently written, I would be inclined to vote no, purely because of my concerns about this language regarding the website. And I don't want to have to vote against the fee increases, etc. Just for your record.
Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Barton, maybe a language could be put in the bill that would say something to the effect that this would go into effect when all these sheriffs in Oregon enter into the agreement.
I'd love it.
We would not be opposed to that, I would assume. So we can definitely check, but that makes perfect sense.
Thank you, Councilor.
Yeah, I would. My concerns were along the same lines. I couldn't figure out why you had, why there was a statement two or more sheriffs. And I think it would make perfect sense that there be some tinkering with the language there to make it very clear that there will be a single website that will be developed, maybe by the Sheriff's Association or something, that all sheriffs will have access to for these purposes. And
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, when we wrote this bill, it did say the Oregon State Sheriff's Association would administer the website. However, at the Legislative Council, they broke that up into what you have in front of you for legal reasons. Apparently, OSSA cannot administer a website themselves, but their political action committee can. And so, from what I understand, the two or more sheriffs can enter into that agreement, and it is their agreement from all 36 counties that they're going to have one website.
And furthermore, on that issue, at the time that we got that information back from Legislative Council, it was then determined that, well, we aren't sure if it's going to be the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. It could be the Marion County Sheriff. It could be the Deschutes County Sheriff. It could be any public government entity or agency that could, in fact, see this through. It could be that, a sheriff's office volunteers to take that on, and then for whatever reason says that we can't do it anymore, and then we can shift that to some other single group.
We'll have, just in the saving time, Mr. Taylor, Mr. Barton can work with Mr. Hendricks, and we'll see if we can't get language, suitable language for that.
That'll cover the scenarios that we're talking about,
right.
But make it really clear that we're not going to have 10 different websites out there.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Gallagher, please. I'm sorry, just a minute, please, Mr. Wallace.
I'm sorry, but on what surprised me on page 2 of the bill, lines 40 and 42, you're taking out the delivery fee for a writ of garnishment by a person other than the sheriff. What's the purpose for the removal of that language? Does that relate to the fee, or does that relate to the ability of the person to, someone other than the sheriff, to deliver a writ of garnishment?
Mr. Taylor, I believe you're talking about line 25. Why are we...
No, excuse me, Mr. Wallace. Lines 40 through 42 on page 2.
Oh, we're moving Right now, the fee for a writ of garnishment for delivery or service is just in the garnishment statutes. We're just wanting to move that in with under sheriff's fees, just so it makes sense. Because right now, 21410, sheriff's fees does not cover a writ of garnishment. It's contained in that other statute. So we're just moving it to make it cleaner.
Give me one further question. So you're not limiting the ability of someone other than the sheriff to deliver a writ of garnishment?
Chair Barker and Representative Taylor, in the garnishment statute itself, it provides that someone other than the sheriff can serve a garnishment as long as they have errors and omissions insurance at up to a certain point. So our intent is just to move the actual fee under the sheriff's fees, but we're leaving alone in the garnishment statute that someone other than us can serve that.
And if you look under line 4, it does say that persons other than a sheriff serving process and other documents may charge any fee agreed to between the server and the person requesting service. So therefore, if the garnishment fee is lumped into 21410, then you're still able to, a private process server with errors and omissions insurance is still able to serve that. So,
thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Gallagher, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Gallagher, representing Oregon Newspaper Publishers. I am not here to object to this bill. We're neutral on it. We've had discussions with the Sheriff's Association about it and understand the position that they're in. What I'm here to do is to raise the issue of public notice and public notice in the Internet, something that we're going to be pursuing a lot more aggressively as we go on in the future. I point out to Representative Barton that we're all sitting here talking about public notice when what they're trying to do is get customers for the sheriff's sale. From our perspective as newspapers, that's called advertising. And we're kind of getting all twisted up when we go back into these statutes and say you have to give notice of the sale, but what you really want to do is get people there. Saw on the other night that one sheriff's sale was actually advertising on television that for folks to come out. And I agree with the debtor-creditor group that they should turn out as many people as they can, and this property should be sold for the value, the highest value that they can. So maybe even in this sense, public notices or legal notices or the requirements of posting are actually prohibiting us from getting where we need to get in terms of the sale. In general, we're moving our way to, on a great many committees and a great many bills, a crossover from using the newspapers as the traditional means of posting legal notices. Most lawyers are very aware of using the newspapers to put different notices they have to give to the public in there, and they're aware of the concept of constructive notice and so forth, which is now beginning to take on a little water. So I think it's a subject that we're going to have to start rethinking as we cross over from newspapers to something else. There's a whole series of qualifications about posting legal notice in the newspaper that you get, including permanence. The notice that's put there doesn't change. It sits there. It's saved and recorded. Right now, you can go back 100 years and pull out public notices from OSU and see what was in them and what happens to them. Internet postings can be changed. There's not a good record of the change. The coverage area is shrinking for newspapers. That's one of the good arguments to say is the readership goes down as they go online. Newspapers are using joint publication now where they'll put something in the newspaper, they'll post it on their websites. People aren't used to that yet. We don't know where they're going to get this information. We have the Daily Journal of Commerce, which posts most of the public contracts in the state. There's a whole generation of people that use the Daily Journal Commerce in physical form, but they also have everything duplicated on the website. So I'm not here to talk about the value to newspapers of having local revenues. That is important to them. I am here to say that most of these sheriff sales and most of these things are going to draw an audience from the community that they're in. You're not going to drive to Gold Beach, which I did this summer, and I missed my appointment, but on the wrong day, but it was a long way down there, and I'm not going to go down there to buy a truck at a sheriff's sale that's going to be local stuff. So not all the people use the websites. What we're going to be beginning to talk about, and not this session, is some criteria for website posting and for alternatives of legal notice. And it may be something, Mr. Chair, because you get this and you're more and more committees. We tried to do a work group on this with local governments 2 years ago. We had a printout that was about 25 pages long of all the different places in statute where we could find a notice that was legally required to be published. Some of them are out of date. Some of them are stupid. Some of them are, the new ones aren't there. And we have a hodgepodge of things that are costing local government money that is being wasted. And we have a whole bunch of things that aren't being posted properly. We should switch some of this to advertising. We should take some of the content out and change it so that you don't squash it down into tiny type at the back of the page. It should be posted somewhere like the Macy's ad or anybody else's ad who wants to get visibility. So I'll stop at that, except that we wanted to take this opportunity with this committee to get on the record, as Representative Barton was beginning to talk about. We haven't thought this thing through. And the good people that work on one section of the statute, it's not their obligation to think this through. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2276. Is that right? No. 2293. Next, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2276.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2276 comes to you from the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division. It requires a child support division to have an assignment of rights before providing support enforcement services. It requires a written application to be signed by the person seeking assistance in collecting of child support. Last known address of the obligor and obligee and acknowledgement that the person is applying for child support services.
You go ahead and, as usual, start as you wish and just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Representative Mark Parker and members of the committee. It's nice to be here on a second day, and I'm hoping that we will be able to present these two bills and answer any questions and move forward here. For the record, my name is Margaret Olney, and I'm special counsel to Attorney General John Kroger. Here today to talk about House Bill 2276. This is a relatively, again, small technical bill that does two things. One is that when we had our audit, we were told that child support orders that we were collecting on, that we were providing service for, that they all needed to be actually signed, have an application that was signed by the parent. And in court orders, often that what we didn't have that. We didn't actually have the signature of the parent applying for services. Since that audit, we have already worked with the courts to include in the judgment essentially a form that requires that signature, and this just puts into the statute that requirement so that we will not so that there can be an automatic referral and beginning of a case when requested based on an existing court order. The second, there's also a provision in here relating to the Internal Revenue Service information on tax intercepts. The IRS prohibits us from telling anybody, including the obligee, that we've received payment from a tax intercept, and this just helps clarify that we're not doing that. So obligees have requested, where'd you get this money from? And we have to say we can't tell you, essentially. And this just puts that in statute and makes it clear. Again, it's an IRS rule that we've already been following, so it's no change. While these changes are relatively technical and have already been implemented, it's necessary for us to have them made in statute in order for our child support plan to remain qualified and receive the federal match. Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office. Just to add a little bit of
history to these two pieces of information and show you where they are in this bill. First, let me say that the reason we did not blend these into the bill that you heard from us yesterday, which was in essence our housekeeping bill, is because these two things are tied to federal requirements, and it's important to us that you assist us by passing these laws so that our state plan remains in compliance. So they were of greater importance than the sort of nice-to-have cleanup you heard yesterday. Sections 1 and 2, as you can see, are just new language to add a descriptor about the requirement for us to have a signature on an application for services. And just to further clarify what Margaret has said, people can come into the child support program at any time, mother or father, and simply by signing a one-page application, they will get services from the program. People often come into our program, however, when they're going through a dissolution, a divorce proceeding, and so rather than just sending us a copy of that dissolution as the courts and the attorneys used to do in the past, they'll send it along with a signature page, which is what they're already doing, to affirmatively make sure we know that the parties are requesting our services. Section 3 is the piece that clarifies the very strict prohibitions on the IRS information. It's vitally important to us that we have IRS information for purposes of the child support program, and so we need to make sure we meet all of the requirements. The very small change you'll find there is on page 3, line 14. The history on this area of the statute is that there are certain pieces of information that we will give to any customer in the child support program, and that's why this law exists. And that might seem sort of like a duh to you, but remember, we are the Department of Justice. We are technically a law office. We cannot talk directly to our customers when they're represented by attorneys. We have to talk to their attorneys. There are certain things that they don't want to go through their attorney, and neither do their attorneys want them calling through them to get, like their account balance. So that's why this law exists. And as Margaret was saying, source of collection really only means to them, we're getting collections through intercepts. We're getting collections through income withholding. We don't ever give out the personal details about where literally a collection comes from. And likewise, we aren't going to differentiate between a state tax offset and a federal tax offset because we can't. We're just going to describe to them that we have that available. All the rest of the bill is legislative counsel going through and conforming with those two pieces of information.
Any questions?
Just real briefly.
Okay.
So it's my understanding that currently the department is already doing both of these things, but you need this memorialized in statute to fully comply with federal requirements. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. Excuse me. Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, that is my understanding.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing. We don't have a fiscal back, so we're going to close the public hearing.
My apologies. One of the things, I apologize, Chair Barker, one of the things that was pointed out in the new language in Section 2, there's also some information about what type of information is included when people are applying for services and coming into the program. And that section of the bill does clarify how that works so that we ensure when we're setting up services we don't give out any information that we shouldn't to the parties, but likewise we need to get the information we need to provide services. So.
Do you want to testify? Go ahead and just identify yourself for the record.
Yes, this is Carl Stecker on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I only wanted to point out that on line 10 of the first page of the bill, subsection B indicates that the obligees need to supply the addresses of the obligor and the obligee. And my point on that is that the applicant may not know the other party's address, and there are sufficient resources often within the program to identify the address of such individuals. And so I question why it's a requirement they supply the address. I think technically the way the legislation reads that the services could be denied for someone who didn't supply the address of the other party. And I only ask that they consider some amendment to cure that problem.
Okay. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2276. Open the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2277. Mr. Tabor.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2277 comes at the request of the Department of Justice Support and Enforcement Division allows for a change in a child support order based on a change in physical custody.
Thank you very much, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Olney, Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger, here today to testify in support of House Bill 2277. And this is a bill that is extremely important to the division. What we're seeking to do is to streamline the process by which we can change, we can modify the amount of support paid based on changed parenting plans. So currently, if there is a parenting plan in place, oftentimes families will informally change custody. They'll say, for the next 6 months, why don't you live with Dad? And in that situation, we have no ability to, you have to go through a complete modification process in order to have custody reflect the changed living arrangements, have child support change reflect the changed custodial or living arrangements of the children. And what this proposal will allow us to do is to essentially create a contingent order in which if the parties agree through a sworn affidavit that we have a changed living arrangement, then it would revert to an alternative form, alternative amount of child support without having to go through the complete modification procedure. Again, what's key is that we're not going to do this without a agreement by the parties, a sworn statement saying that we agree that the living arrangement has changed, and then that would trigger our ability to recalculate the support based on that changed arrangement and do it in an expedited way so that we don't have the person who's now has the child living at home all having to pay child support or having the wages garnished to send to the currently non-custodial parent. We can have it move much more quickly. This will aid the families as well as streamline and ease administrative costs for us.
And Chair Barker, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Ron Alshenkel with the Attorney General's Office. Just to follow up briefly on what Margaret had said, I know you're not used to me coming in front of this committee and saying that we have parents that agree on something, but in fact, we do often have parents that agree on things, and we are experiencing more scenarios where they have custody orders and parenting time plans in place, and then they make other arrangements based on their family dynamic and life situation to temporarily change that. And we do want this to be an expedited process. As Margaret said, we want that money to get to the children. So setting up what we call contingency language will allow us to enter orders that cover both of those scenarios and basically turn on and turn off the support to follow the child based on the physical residence. Classic example is perhaps father has primary custody, but during the summer, mother's going to have physical custody. So we would have the ability with notice, with chance to object, to make sure everybody does agree, that we would be able to switch that without a full modification. The important language in the bill to you in Section 2, it only applies to Chapter 416. Those are all administrative orders, so we're only putting this responsibility on the child support program to do this. No impact on the courts. Also, line 10, again, the knowledge and consent of the other parent has to be there, or we're going to go into a full modification process and handle that as we normally would. It does require a sworn affidavit, as you can see on line 13. And then lines 18 and 19 make it very clear that just because we're adjusting child support based on the child's physical custody changing in no way impacts that underlying custody agreement or parenting time plan with the court. If they want to change those things, they still go through a full modification process on that as well.
So this, what this essentially does is if a couple agrees if to just make some change, they don't have to go through a whole court proceeding. They can do it much cheaper for the family and for the for everybody. It's just a quick, easy way to make a temporary change.
Chair Barker, you've hit the nail on the head. It's for those temporary changes, but those things that go longer than just a weekend visitation or a summer visitation.
Representative Garrett.
Is it envisioned that all orders would have this contingency provision in there?
Good question, Chair Barker and Representative Garrett. Absolutely not. This would be for those unique family situations where they have a pattern of this occurring and they come to us and say, look, we do this every year. We've worked it out. Please help us.
Has this been vetted through the family law section of the bar?
Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, yes, it has. We met in person with the family law section legislative subcommittee. Susan Graby and David Gannett were our point people.
Okay. And as far as you know, there's not an objection.
Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, because we're suggesting that we only do this in the program at this time, no, there was no objection.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say, speaking to the record, slightly off topic, I just wanted to say thanks yesterday for our after session conversation about and your Margaret Olney's comments about providing or facilitating visitation as both a method of getting greater dual parent contact with children, as well as a lever to promote greater payment of people support obligations. I appreciate that, and if over time there are pieces of legislation that help facilitate that, I'm your Huckleberry. Let me know.
Thank you.
Could you put that on the record again? Your what?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would
A public hearing on House Bill 2277. Open a work session on House Bill 2277. We have the fiscal. There's no impact on that.
Consent.
And we, if everybody's in agreement, we'll move this one to the consent calendar as well. Okay, I'll accept a motion to move this to the floor to do pass to the consent calendar. Sonny's on. Representative Stigler moves House Bill 2277 to the floor to do pass to the consent calendar. Is there any more discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisner?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. We have one more item of business today. We have another LC draft to put in as a committee bill. Specifies how monies payable under settlement agreement entered into on behalf of a minor or judgment in favor of a minor shall be paid. By authorizing this bill does not mean you need to support it in the future, just that we're introducing it. I accept a motion to introduce LC 2398 as a committee bill.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant moves LC 2398 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion, objections? We need to take a move on.
Don't have to vote.
Okay. Hearing no objections, so ordered.
Boom.
Done. No further business before the committee day. Adjourned.